and it's time for our afternoon sessions to begin. This session will be about an hour and 45 minutes long, with a break about midway, in which we will get up and sing a stanza of a song and then sit down and resume. We will like to announce at this time that there will be a class for the ages 4 through 7 in room number 120. Brother David Stoics will take care of that session. 4 to 7 year olds, room 120. And now, dear friends, to open the session, the afternoon session, let us turn to hymn number 79, Brother Levi's choice, Brother 79, number 79, and sing the first two stanzas, number 1 and 2. Rise on number 2, if you please. And now, to lead our thoughts in prayer for opening this session, we've asked on our dear brother Joe Knapp of the Garden Prairie, Illinois, to lead our thoughts in prayer.
Our most kind and most gracious Heavenly Father, with thankful hearts before we come before Thee at this time, appreciating what all we've heard this morning, appreciating the brethren of the Bloit Ecclesia who have opened this facility and this convention to us, who have just filled our bodies with the most bountiful feast. And now, Father, they have brought to our attention Brother Levi Jacobs, who will fill our spiritual minds with the most bountiful feast. We ask, Father, that our hearts and our minds be opened to receive what he has to say to us, that thou would guide his words, that it be richly blessing to us, and that we would receive it, put it to use in our lives in a daily way, that we do reap what is here sown in our hearts. Be with us, Father, with all the fullness of thy Spirit throughout this session, for we ask it in Jesus' most precious name. Amen.
And now, dear brethren, at this time, we are going to call on our dear brother Levi Jacobs. We also do not need to introduce him. You know him. And he is going to discuss with us Nahum 1, 2, and 3. Nahum 1, 2, and 3. Brother Jacobs.
Very happy indeed to share the meditations of our thoughts on this momentous subject. It might not have appealed to you as a momentous subject for the reason that you have not heard any previous expositions of Nahum, but in the providences of the Lord, I believe that this has been divinely arranged, for we are in the period, as has been sung in the hymn, where the symbols, the symbolic language of the prophets are being unfolded, and we identify that with the definition of the book of Revelation. And that's what Revelation is about. It might have been previously viewed as a book of hidden symbols, but that was only because the time for the Epiphania had not come to full fruition. I say fruition because epiphany, the epiphania of the parousia, run close together. Immediately after the parousia occurred in 1874, within 4 or 5 years later, the epiphania process began, because it merely referred to the revealing or the making manifest of the presence of Christ. And as soon as the doctrine of the presence of Christ became known and circulated amongst the brethren, you began the epiphania period, which was the manifestation of his presence. Now that progresses, as we say. Of course, you run into the apocalypsis eventually, which will be when Israel's turn to recognize the presence of Christ occurs, which will be a great event. And then it just says, every eye shall see him, and they which pierced him shall also recognize him, and they shall mourn. Their recognition of Christ's presence will be a mournful one at the beginning. They shall mourn for him as one mourneth for only son, and being bitterness as one is in bitterness for her firstborn. And then, of course, there will be a great deal of mourning in conjunction with the trouble that they go through, Jacob's trouble, and its finality. Everything now has to be gradually expanded to its ultimate fruition. That's the way God does things. That's why you have overlapping periods on your chart. So this is the nature, this is the principle of God. You don't run into a chronological static point of time, and then an age ends, and then you begin another static point of time, and a new age begins. You have it here, the overlapping period in which one age merges into the other, and while it is working its way out, the other is working its way in. So that's the principle of God. That's the graduality of God's operations, because the things that God deals with are so comprehensive and so large that we need time to adjust our visions and comprehension to these changes. So even in this gospel age and versus the millennial age, of which the harvest is the beginning, is the ending of an age, and it is also the beginning of an age, you see, because they both overlap within the harvest. So you've got to get this double viewpoint in order to understand God's method of operation. So the apocalypsis, which is the new phase of the parousia, superimposed on the epiphania, is when every eye shall see him, beginning with the Jew after Jacob's trouble, and spreading to all nations on a universal basis. The epiphania, of course, is for the church. In terms of the fruition of it, will be when the church is completed and glorified with the Lord. Then they too shall share in the manifestation of the Christ to the world. We participate in that manifestation. So revelation, by definition, is an unveiling and a revealing of the secret things of God's plans and purposes and prophecies, which you have access to now. It's for your benefit. It's for the church. All things are written for the church. So you should be aware of your privileges in investigating these prophecies. Now, the same applies to the prophets. In Matthew, the 24th chapter, for example, the great prophecy is being widely delved into and considered by the brethren, as I understand Revelation is also, because they recognize that this is the time for the unfolding of these prophecies. And now with the prophets, as we say, the same is happening, beginning with Moses and running down through the whole gamut of the prophecies. They're all coming out on an epiphaniac level of manifestation. This is in conjunction with the throne scene of which we advised you in our previous message yesterday. I didn't dwell on that particular aspect of it, but it's a beautiful feature thereof, along with the seven lamps of fire and the four beasts or living creatures surrounding the throne. We run into the 24 elders. They're an essential part of this throne scene. They are called the Sanhedrin, which is correspondent, it's a Hebrew term for judges and deciders of fates. And that's what they were. Their judgment stood. And the 24 elders were a very vital part of, as we say, of this revelation presentation. They represent the prophecies. There happens to be 24 prophets, but that is not to limit the concept of prophecies in number, because all the prophecies are comprehended under this figure of the 24 elders. So they didn't have to be 24 individual prophets. It's just that they comprehend, that number comprehends the body of prophecy as it is presented in the Old Testament. They had crowns for the reason that they were infallible. That's a tremendous word to work with, infallibility. Brother Russell had nothing to do with that. He never even pretended to claim infallibility, and he wouldn't have welcomed anyone imposing that responsibility on him. The apostles had it. Yes, whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. But they were very careful in using it, because Paul would say that this is my mind. Don't mix it up with the mind of the Lord. So that's an infallibility. It's a very restricted area of authenticity. But with the prophets, their prophecies and their words were infallible. That whatsoever they said was the divine edict on the matter, and it was the last word. That's why they had crowns, to indicate that they were divinely authorized to speak what they spoke. There's an indication there also of God's predestination on behalf of the church, because Peter says that all of these prophets wrote and spoke things that they did not understand, and that the angels also wanted to learn about what time or manner of time the Spirit spoke of when it referred to these various events. But it said that it was written for our benefit, the church. Imagine all these things being done just for us, not just for Jesus. There were things that Jesus didn't mention at his time because it wasn't due. In his first famous discourse, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because he's anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, to bind up the brokenhearted, and so forth. He left out the part of Isaiah. He's quoting from Isaiah. That's where he opened the book, about declaring the day of vengeance of our Lord. Why? It wasn't due. It's a due time in all of God's arrangements for things to be revealed. So he left that for us. See, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet who declare these prophecies concerning thy God reigneth, in conjunction with the day of vengeance of our God, the day of preparation. That's our privilege. So as we say, these things were written for the church, for our benefit, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And that puts us in a very privileged position, and a responsible one, for studying these things out and finding out what the application of their meaning is at this present time. With the rapidly increasing momentum of the signs, quotation marks, that Jesus referred to, when ye see these things, it becomes necessary to be extra alert to the possibilities of their significance. You may not recognize them all at once. That's why the Lord gives multiple signs and increases the crescendo to bring us into a spirit of readiness for the grand climactic events that will be suddenly merge upon the scene, and which only the church will be aware of, because it pertains to their finishing their course here on earth. If you're going to be here, if you like the environment and you're looking forward to the millennial blessings, then you don't have to worry about that. You don't need any signs. You just need to get comfortable. But to those who are planning to leave, they need signs. And that's what these signs are for. Your redemption draweth nigh. So Nahum, as we say, is providentially put into our consideration at this moment to let us realize what we have access to. There's not too much presented on it, but we have the keys. And that's what we need to work with. We start off with the events that I have been brought to my attention very propitiously, that I think verifies the beauty of considering this type of prophecy. I understand, if those of you who have heard it, raise your hand, that there's been an earthquake yesterday. How many have heard about that? Thank you. Germany, Austria, Switzerland. That's a big area. You know all about the propensity of the present system to earthquakes, but you didn't think it would happen just on time like that. That's what's happened. Highly significant. Another message was brought to my attention that when we left Evansville, I got it going and coming. When I was going, the brother drove me, told me that he had been in a storm. And now I understand that the brother in going, returning home, he said he ran into a two-hour thunderstorm in which the lightning was so glaring like he had never seen before. Said it stroked across the whole skies, which lightning usually sometimes is grounded. But it streaked across the whole sky with multiple prongs and lighted up the area. Now, we've got documentation on that. Every time we get a storm, we watch it. And I get up out of my bed. I enjoy it. Many of the brethren are fearful. And they go into their closets, I understand. I get out the bed. I consider that's a signal. And sit on my porch and watch it, and it's beautiful to see the heavens in the middle of the night light up with a blinding glare and to see those streaks of red fire cut across the sky. And then you hear the thunder rolling and the cannonball reverberations. And that's where you have the earthquakes. Those of you who come from California, how many of you here from California? Thank you. You verify what I'm saying. When they get them out there, they get them with the rumblings. And the last one, they had so many multiple rumblings that I don't know if they had a strict tabulation on it. Nahum brings this all to our attention. And so we think that this is an indication that we're on the right track. We know that we're studying signs of heaven. This is part of the throne scene. When the throne scene is presented, usually these elements go together. Lightning, thunder, voices, earthquakes, and the final climactic events is hail, which we've been getting a lot of that. I just got a communication from one of our brethren in the Nebraska area who was affected by the hail that was the size. We used to be settled with the size of golf balls, and at that. And now I understand they're baseballs sizes. So I don't know what that, you know. That's whoa. Yeah, and it did do the damage. Many car windows were smashed, and their roof was involved in the damage, and they're now in the process of repairing their roof. So they claimed that the roofers are having a great heyday. And hail is very damaging. Where would you go? Man, the sixth seal says that the men would blaspheme God because of the size of the hail. That's the final great, tremendous earthquake in the 16th chapter of Revelation, in which the city of the nations is divided into three parts, and they fall, and then you get the lightning, the thunder, and the hail. So these are the signs that we are in the midst of. Now, Nahum, we break it down briefly on a chapter basis because you have to put it together in order to get the picture. It's not given in sequence, and that's to make a study more. You know, the scripture says, here a little, there a little, line upon line, and precept upon precept. So don't be discouraged because you don't find a consistent exposition of any one topic when you're studying your Bible. You have to dig it out, and the more we dug, the more we found. And so we had the problem of putting it together so that we can present it in an orderly fashion. The first chapter is a classical chapter. Oh, I wanted to let you into the viewpoint that we think is applicable here. When we speak of the 24 elders as being the prophecies, therefore it is our concept that there is no such thing as a minor prophet. The nomenclature was given to identify those who had lesser writings and less copious writings than some of the other prophets like Ezekiel and Jeremiah and those who had lengthier writings. But that does not make them a minor prophet, because these prophecies under the 24 elder pictures that had crowns are the divine mind, the representation of the divine purposes. And it was God who determined just how lengthy certain writings should be and how limited certain writings should be, not because of any lesser importance attached to it, but because he wanted us to realize that it's the prophecies and not the individual that we have to take notice of. So in this particular limited presentation of Nahum, he identifies and relates himself to all the major prophets. And Daniel was the other one I was trying to tell you about. You know Daniel. Everybody knew Daniel? Sure. He sees that great big image, you know, with the head of gold, breast and arms, silver and the belly and the thigh, brass and the legs of iron and the toes of iron mixed with clay, which is the era that comes right down to our day. A tremendous coverage, you see. And so Daniel, of course, we're familiar with. That's the smiting of the image. So, as I say, Nahum, in his short space of exposition, identifies himself with all of these major prophets, and we will give you an illustration of that in the first chapter. That's where the first chapter immediately exalts him into the realm of the majors. The burden of Nineveh, the book of division of Nahum, the Elkoshite. Nineveh, of course, is verified by Jesus, who refers to the Jews and compares them to the Ninevites in his own words. He says that the Ninevites would be raised up and would condemn that particular generation. For as Jonas was a sign unto the Ninevites, this is Luke 11:31-32. For as Jonas was a sign unto the Ninevites, so shall also the Son of Man be to this generation. There he's using the word generation in terms of the stock of which they were a part of. He's not using it as he refers to the end of the age. He's using it pertaining to them. They were not the righteous generation. We had defined that for you. But they were the generation that were doomed. So you see, you make your distinctions there. So then he says, so shall also the Son of Man be to this generation. Now he brings in Ethiopia there, and that's interesting. We might as well throw that in for good measure. The Queen of the South shall rise up in judgment with the men of this generation and condemn them. For she, that's Sheba, came from the utmost parts of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, a greater than Solomon is here. That's why Africa is coming into focus again, because God has Ethiopia on his agenda for redealing. Assyria, Egypt, they're all on his agenda for redealing with them, even as he redeals with Israel. The next verse, the men of Nineveh shall rise up in judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, for they repented at the preaching of Jonas, and behold, a greater than Jonas is here. So therefore Nineveh is mentioned by Jesus. We're not talking about Jonas. That's not our subject. You know, the brother came up and said, are you going to talk about Amos? That'll be another time. So I've got an advanced agenda for me, you see. You remember that, Brother Ed? But we're talking about Nineveh. And so we don't want you to get your mind on Jonah, but on Nahum. So we have established the importance of Nineveh because Jesus identifies Nineveh in his vocabulary. Then he says, God is jealous and the Lord revengeth. Now, we just had a presentation on that about the anger of God. Oh, it's consistent with his love because it's a righteous indignation. It's in the inevitable concomitant of justice. That's why he has attributes. He's not, when it says he's all love, he doesn't mean that you ignore his other attributes. You can't do that. That's why they're all given together as four, whether it's around the throne as living creature, or whether it's in Ezekiel's wheels that operate in conjunction with these multi-headed creatures, because they all operate together. So justice inevitably has to take vengeance and justifies anger when there is a situation that has to be righted and weighed in the balance and corrected. So God is jealous and the Lord revengeth. The Lord revengeth and is furious. The Lord will take vengeance on his adversaries, and he reserveth wrath for his enemy. So you're familiar with the other text that tells us the Lord is angry with the wicked. How often?
Every day.
Every day. Now you're beginning to understand how God works, you see. And so this is why Nahum is fully justified in presenting this aspect of God's character to our attention. The Lord is slow to anger, great in power, and will not at all acquit the wicked. That's the unchangeableness of our God, who changes not, in whom there is no variableness or shadow of turning. You might change your mind. You might have a reversal of your original intention, but God does not break that way. He doesn't. He's not variable, in whom there's no variableness nor changeableness. And so he will not acquit the wicked. That's the point here. The Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. There's Ezekiel. That brings you up to date. As a matter of fact, we have suggestions to review some consideration of Ezekiel's wheel. So we'll bear that in mind because that's very applicable in terms of what this context brings to our attention. Now we turn to Ezekiel and just give you briefly, this is the main issue today. This is where Ezekiel tells you what we're to face. In 1:4 he says, "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north." That's a divinely ordered force of energy. Usually whirlwinds come out of the south, which means that sometimes the adversary can get involved. But this is out of the north, from the throne area. So the Lord is arranging this. The whirlwind comes out of the north, a great cloud. And what? Fire. Now you know that you're dealing with God. Fire. Enfolding itself. It's inwardly generated. It's like the sun. They've just made a breakthrough on that. We used to deal with fission. Anyone here is in that field? We used to deal with fission, which means that you had to get up to 10 million degrees, if you can conceive of that type of heat, and it causes the atoms and electrons and protons to jump around, and they bombard one another, and that creates a form of energy, which is relevant to the sun. They finally made a breakthrough. This is what Nahum projects you to, because it's the day of his preparation. For great things, beloved. The day of his preparation. You can see that. This is what all the restitution signs are about. It's the day of his preparation for a change of government and administration. Big things are at stake that will require perfect minds to cope with. As it is now, they threaten to engulf humanity in self-destruction. They're too big for a man in his state of mind as he is to cope with. And he's frightened. But it's the day of his preparation because he has competent administrators to handle these large, overwhelming problems when they come back with perfect minds, the ancient worthies. So this new breakthrough that we're referring to is called fusion. Now, they couldn't get to this particular attainment because they couldn't exceed 10 million degrees enough to be able to create fusion, which means it's a merging of these atoms and protons and electrons. And so they keep regenerating themselves. See? They keep generating heat. So it's an infinite process. So they finally made a breakthrough and were able to go up to 65 million degrees. How do you like that for heat? Of course, you wonder what could contain that heat. That's another problem. But, of course, they scientifically work on that problem, too. So now they've done it. And so now they went from fission to fusion. They've got the sun. What a fantastic concept. So you can bring the sun now onto Earth, and they'll start regenerating a new type of energy that will exceed the ability of man now to even imagine. It'll take a few years to do that. Now, all of this is just a sample of the breakthroughs. In the electrical field, it's the same thing. In all fields, it's in the medical field. We had those questions discussed. Restitution processes, no doubt, are implied. So, this enfolding fire, what we told you about, is the nature of inherent energy that regenerates itself. And this is the nature of the sun. And a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, and out of the midst of the fire, what happened? Out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures. There's your throne identification again. And this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, meaning that, of course, God's attributes have been presently focused on man's problem and redemption. Behold, a man, Christ Jesus, has been selected to be the redeemer and the ransom for man in order to give him deliverance from the thraldom of sin and death. So they were like in the likeness of a man. So you see, Nahum now has properly identified himself with Ezekiel. And therefore he has great status and authenticity already. Now he didn't stop there. He goes on. In the storm and in the clouds are the dust of his feet. Now he says, he rebuketh the sea and maketh it dry and drieth up the rivers. What does that bring to your attention? That, now you project to the symbolic and we are immediately reminded of Euphrates. Because in Revelation we're told that in conjunction with the one of the plagues, 16:12 it probably should be, and the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east should be prepared. We would dwell on that by itself and would be an interesting subject. Now, this river Euphrates, the water thereof, is the river upon which Babylon sits. Nineveh, of course, is a prototype of this arrangement. She sits on waters and peoples. This one which thou sawest, that's where she rests. Her support comes from languages, nations, peoples, tongues. And this drying up of the river Euphrates will be her downfall. And so the Lord is prepared to deal with this great system on this basis. It's very gradual, you know. We told you that God works on a gradual basis. It's not sudden. It doesn't happen in any one lifetime. That's why you have problems in identifying the fulfillment of prophecy, because you have a limited concept that they should happen in this time or that limited context, not realizing that the time is not an element with God. The end and the beginning doesn't make any difference. It's the fact that he said it. That's all that counts. He spoke, and it was done. How long did it take? It might take 1,000,000 years. And God said, light, let there be light. And there was light. What do you think, just like that? Oh, no. That goes into all the evolutionary processes. The earth was dark, and the earth was darkness, it was void, and there was no light or energy in it, except that it existed. But when God said, let there be light, then he put into motion all these various forces and energies that were surrounding the earth and preparing the earth so that it could allow light to come in. First on a gradual basis, because there was a canopy preventing it, and that was good to prevent certain tremendous growths in vegetation and gigantic green vegetation. And but then later on, the light pierced, that particular canopy was broken, and the light would pierce through more, and then you could get the light of the sun and the moon and the stars, and that was the answer. Let there be light. It may have taken millions of years for that. That's not a factor with God. So that's what we have to understand. So when it says, in 6 days, God created the earth, he's not talking about 24-hour days. In this particular case, he's not even talking about 1,000-year days, which is a pretty good stretch of the imagination. He's talking about each of these days being 7,000 years long, ending up in a 49,000-year period, leading to the great antitypical 50,000 year, which coincides with the Jubilee cycles of the millennium picture. So time is not the element in prophecy. So this drying up of the river Euphrates is not meant to happen in Brother Russell's day or in your day, limited necessarily, but it'll be our day, because our day is the Lord's day. The Lord's day is 1,000 years. All right, so that's the rebuking of the sea. Maketh it dry, drieth up the river. Now, here we have it, what we have a confirmation of today as the divine authenticity to the message that Nahum presents. The mountains quake at him. Unless you believe in the presence of Christ, you could not relate this picture. The mountains quake at him. Who told us about the volcanoes all over the world, the volcano. In Italy, they had them going on so strong that they were wiping out villages over there. That lava, you know, when it erupts and belches forth and runs down the mountain, they could show the white heap of ash over the cars and homes that just melted them. That's hot. Comes from the molten center of the earth. So that was in Italy. They have Vesuvius and Etna and all these great, Hawaii, someone was out there, all these volcanoes, mountains, quake. And of course, they're a reflection of the quaking of the earth, indicating that this tremendous activity in the unfinished earth state that is being brought to bear on the present situation of judgment. So the mountains quake at him and the hills melt. And the earth is burned at his presence, yea, the world and all that dwell therein. Now, the literal, of course, is merely the symbol of the symbolical application, because the mountains represent the governments. That's a larger picture. It takes a little more comprehension to identify with that picture, because that's also a gradual picture. So you get a tremendous government quaking, and you might not see it right away. But now you're beginning to see it on a more precipitous basis because you're seeing the end results. It takes a long time for preparations and factors to affect the government, which is strong and powerful and well-entrenched. But eventually, it'll quake and it'll tremble and it'll fall. And hills the same way, they will eventually melt. So you have that situation going on presently in Nicaragua, where they went in and took in the government territory, if you don't mind. That's another new boldness, element of boldness. They went into where the people were in the government building and paying their taxes, and I guess it was about 200 or 500 of them, and they went in and surrounded the whole people, kept them hostage, demanded their $10 million and the freedom of their associates, guerrilla associates, and won their point. Made them send a plane and escort them. I saw this, beloved. Today you can see things, you see. I don't have to tell you what I heard about. That's the medium that we have now. And they got on that plane and they went away. You saw the men. They talked on TV and told them what they were about to do. And they're very pleased with their work. And they're going to come back when they get ready. The hills melting at his presence. So there again, you see how Nahum identifies himself with the major prophets. The earth is burned. Peter tells you about that. The day of the Lord comes. And I'd like to give it to you from Peter's words because they're so graphic. And he says, the heavens being on fire and the earth also. So you see, that's what Nahum says about the earth burning, that this is a very dramatic event. And the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. And the earth also and the works therein shall be burned up. That's what Nahum was before Peter. Beloved, you see. So you could say Peter was quoting from Nahum. So you see, this is divine prophecy. See, this is not a minor situation here. This is a major situation for a prophet to be able to project us to the mind of the Lord even before the apostles came on the scene. The earth shall be burned up. And he says, we are looking and hasting unto the coming of the Lord God, wherein the heavens being on fire shall be dissolved. Imagine that. And the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nahum tells us that. So he identifies himself with Peter, who was an apostle. Who can stand before his indignation? And who can abide in the fierceness of his anger? His fury is poured out like fire, and the rocks are thrown down by him. That's Malachi. Who shall abide the day of the Lord? Who shall stand when he appear? Because he is refined as fire and is full of soap. And he shall deal with the sons of Levi and purify them as gold and silver. It's identified with another major prophecy. That's the dealing with the Lord's coming. The Lord whom ye seek shall suddenly come to his temple. So this is where we are dealing. And he also reminds us about the rocks being thrown down. He brings us over to Revelation. You remember the sweet flute of John harmonizes with what Nahum is bringing us to. The sixth chapter of Revelation, then you get your earthquakes again. This is why it's so important. We're not overestimating them at all. We probably have to be extra alert now to keep up with the momentum that they're occurring. So in the sixth chapter, under the sixth seal, he says, I beheld when he had the 12th verse, of Revelation, I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became as blood. That's the lack of insight into the appreciation of the gospel message and the Old Testament teachings because of infidelity, higher criticism, and other plagues inundating the religious heavens. Russell told you all about that. Now he tells you what there's been a lot of discussion about amongst Bible students pertaining to the merging of the heavens, which they identify with state and church federation, but they haven't got the divine insight on the matter. See, take it from Nahum when we get through, beloved. He says, "And the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together," which means that they're coming together to be sure, but for their preparing for being eliminated, because he says the heavens shall pass away. So this is the same heavens. It's they're rolling together as a scroll is in preparation for their dissolution. So why do you concentrate on their power? There's no more power in the heavens. And any semblance of it, whatever it looks like, is merely the rise before the fall. But the fall is the picture that we're interested in. That's the prophetic point of view. You're not interested in any intermediary situation. He's interested in the end result. So he tells us that. He says, after he says that the stars, it gives us the earthquake, the sun became black as sackcloth, the moon became as blood, and the stars of heaven fell unto the earth. That's the picture of these heavens as we understand the nominal heavens being involved there. What, that's true. The stars, they have no spiritual enlightenment there. They're all earthly-minded sociologists today, political sociologists, I beg your pardon. So they fell to earth. And the heavens departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. Oh, no, I missed the main part here. The stars of heaven fell onto the earth, even as a fig tree casteth her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind. Who said the winds weren't loose? Watch them stars fall. Oh, yeah. You're lucky to see the trees now pretty soon being hurt. Well, those wouldn't have been loose, beloved. Yes, long time. But gradually, they increase in momentum so that the church doesn't become affected negatively or disadvantageously before her work is accomplished. Hold back the winds until we have sealed the servants of God. Doesn't mean that they're not going to be loosed. It means that they're not going to be permitted to do their full damage until the church has completed her work. But the loosing began way back in 1914. So this is the effect of these mighty winds shaking figs off a tree, which means that the nominal churches and the nominal heavens is disintegrating. The heavens depart as a scroll when it is rolled together, because for fear they begin to come together for their protection, and every mountain and island were moved out of their places. Don't you see that going on? You know a stable government anywhere in the world? I was going to say in the country. No, in the world, because this country hasn't got a stable government. We've got to forget about that. Used to be. We haven't got one. And I've got to say, do you know a stable government anywhere in the world? They're shaking and trembling with the volcanic equivalent of earth tremors. And so as he says here, the mountains were removed and the islands were removed out of their places. So you're in the last phase of the last effects of the seven plagues. Now then, having made that clear, we continue with Nahum's, the rocks. Oh, I wanted to tell you about the rocks. I shouldn't have, because that's very present tense situation. The rocks. He says, the kings of the earth and the great men and the rich men and the chief captains and the mighty men and every bondman and every free man hid themselves in dens and the rocks of mountains. What do you suppose that means? Well, now you've got it. Your societies, your organizations, your unions, and your post offices. You believe it now? That was a big, strong rock. But that rock is falling, and it hurts us, too. If they ever go out on a strike, everybody will feel it. See, this is the position that he's bringing on us, he said. So they were hiding themselves in these protections. They get into the unions, and then they can really shake a government. See, so he says that they hid themselves in the dens and in the rocks of the mountains, and they said to the mountains, rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. These unions are saying to protect them from the imperial rule and arbitrary functions of capitalist society. And when they don't get that protection, they revolt, and somebody's going to get hurt. So there's, Nahum projects that when he says, the rocks are affected by the judgments of the Lord. But the Lord is a good stronghold in the day of trouble. Isn't that nice to know? And he knoweth them that trust in him. Seek meekness and seek righteousness, and it may be that ye may be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. For the church, he says, hide thyself. Go into thy chambers. Shut thy doors about thee. Hide thyself until his indignation be overpassed. That's about the position that we are relating to. We are taking advantage of our opportunities for spiritual refreshment and edification, and we're not getting involved in any of these extraneous activities and political machinations that are going on around about us. Most of the church, I'm sure, don't vote. We try not to be part of unions if we don't have to. If we do, we take it in a rather casual way and make known our positions. But we're hiding ourselves and going into our chambers and getting ourselves prepared for our future inheritance. And while we still are aware of what's going on all about us. So he is a good stronghold, and he knoweth them to trust in him. And for those who are looking towards the ways of righteousness, seek meekness and righteousness, and it may be that ye may be hid also. Now, why do ye imagine against the Lord? That's Psalms, how he identifies himself. Why do the nations rage? The people imagine a vain thing. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and his anointed. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. You ever heard God laugh? You should see the effects of it. He's laughing now. That's why they're all in trouble. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. The day of perplexity. They don't know their way out. The more problems that they cope with, they multiply. And so that's God's laughing at them. See if you can unsolve yourselves. Can't do it. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Yet have I set my king upon the holy hill of Zion. And make sure that you pay attention to him and his new government. Kiss the son, lest he be angry. You heard about that. And ye perish when his wrath be kindled but a little bit. That's the day in which we are. Why do you imagine, Nahum says, against the Lord? He will make an utter end. Affliction shall not rise up the second time. That's the thrust of his message in the first chapter. In the second chapter, I'm going to give you some more information on that. In the second chapter, we get into the elements. Of course, this is a literal picture as well as symbolical. Israel is involved in being under the yoke of these various nations and shuttled from one to another according to the power that they were exercising. So Israel was in the midst of the raging sea of nations, sweeping across the horizon in their lust to conquer and to acquire power. So you had the Assyrians, you had the Medes, you had the Arabian nation, you had Egypt, you had Babylon, and then you go run on down the list of Daniel's image, and you had Medo-Persia and Greece and Rome, of course, during which time Israel had been scattered. But at this time, she was not yet in that particular situation. She was able to see the Lord's vengeance upon her enemy. And this is why Nahum exults in this. So these nations were only permitted to pillage Israel when Israel was in need of judgment. But other than that, they were pawns in the hand of God to fulfill his purposes. And yet the prophet was able to pinpoint their destiny. Now the second chapter deals with this situation as affects these nations. And he doesn't bring in Israel here so much, except to indicate that the Lord will protect Israel. In that situation, he has brought you up to the present state of affairs. Chapters 2 and 2, he says, for the Lord has turned away, or turned again, the excellency of Jacob as the excellency of Israel, for the emptiers have emptied out and marred their vine branches, which means now that all of Israel's enemies have exhausted themselves, and the Lord is again going to restore the pride and excellency of Jacob and Israel. He's going to restore them to their position of favor. So the yoke of these nations that have ruled over Israel shall be broken, just as it was in the case of Egypt. So you see, you're right up to the present state of affairs. Egypt is being again brought to our attention in terms of her threat to Israel. But Nahum sees the end result. So he gives us he glories in God's judgment against these nations, which is where we can see also the outcome of the Jacob's trouble situation. See, Jacob is mentioned here. Now then, so he goes into the various Nineveh in the 8th verse. But Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. There's your prototype of Babylon, whose stronghold was water. Nineveh was surrounded by water. Tyre and Babylon, their stronghold was water. In order to get in, remember, when it was while they were still, while Babylon, not Babylon, but Nebuchadnezzar was... Or it was Belshazzar, beg your pardon, the succeeder to Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar was exulting in his Bacchanalian feasts and revelry, having taken the golden vessels from the temple, how dare him, and brought them over to his court and used them for his wine festival. And Daniel... before Daniel gets into the picture, he saw something going on the wall. He saw a hand without a body. What would you do if you saw that? Writing on the wall. Mene! Mene! Tekel Upharsin. And he didn't know what that meant, but he knew something strange was happening. When you see hands and no body, you know something's going to happen. And he got trembling, and his knees began to quake. And he wanted to know who knows anything about this. And he called for all the wise men. And finally, his mother or grandmother remembered that we have a man that had survived all these previous governments of his father's empire and so forth, kings, I should say. And he knows about these things. He has a God that can. He said, "Get him over here right away." So they did, and they subpoenaed Daniel. Daniel came in and stood up before the king. And the king says, "Are you able to decipher these things on this wall?" Daniel says, not me, but there is a God who's able to do this. And then he spelled it out. Mene, mene, tekel upharsin. Thy days are numbered. Thou hast been weighed in the balances, and thou hast been found wanting. And no sooner had that message been pronounced than they heard the rumblings of the outside attack. Why? Because Cyrus had sent his troops under the gates. They were thought they were impregnable. That's why he was enjoying a good time. But Cyrus had devised a strategy for undermining Babylon by diverting the waters, digging trenches and so forth, sending in his troops under those gates. The gates were thrown open, and into the palace they came, and they slew those men. Daniel, of course, escaped, and indeed became a prime counselor to the next government under Cyrus. And this is the mighty workings of prophecy, because this is what the Lord was depicting for what was to happen to antitypical Babylon at our time. And we'll proceed with that at the brother's discretion.
This is called a tape break. And while we break the tapes, we'll sing the third stanza of number 79. Number 79, the third stanza. And please rise. I imagine you'll be glad to do so for a people break. that sufficient, brethren?
Yes.
You may be seated, brother.
I think we left you at Babylon falling. That's the present picture, beloved, anatypically speaking.
Don't forget, we're coming just to Nahum projection.
So as we say, we read in the second chapter, he says, but Nineveh is of old like a pool of water. Yet they shall flee away. Stand, stand, shall they cry, but none shall look back. And that rhymes well with Revelation in terms of what Revelation says of Babylon, the great, where he speaks about her, the enemies of Babylon, or her friends, I should say, that watch her destruction, and they mourn for her. We'll see if we can find that quickly enough for you. And the kings of the earth stand afar off. This is in 18:9. We'll begin with 8 because we told you about the plagues. Therefore shall her plagues come in one day. And there's been some doubt about the plagues having been poured out among some of the brethren. They've been long poured out, beloved. What you're getting are the reverberating effects of the multiple plagues running concentrically at the same time, or concurrently, and affecting Babylon at the same time. This is a world global picture, you know. And so all the plagues are affecting her. And she's feeling the effects. So, therefore shall her plagues come in one day, death and mourning and famine, and she shall be utterly burned with fire. That's the typical method of destruction. For strong is the Lord God who judges her. This is where Nahum's exaltation comes in, as we just sung. We rejoice with the prophets in the fulfillment of prophecy. The kings of the earth who have committed fornication and live deliciously with her shall bewail her and lament for her when they shall see the smoke of her burning. All of these who were formerly her friends are mourning over her imminent dissolution. And this is what Nahum says. She's empty and void and waste. The heart melteth, the knees smite together, and much pain is in all loins, and the faces of them all gather blackness. What do you think happened to this last pope, Paul, when his best friend, a magnet and a honorable man in the government arrangements, Moreau, was kidnapped and held hostage for 40 days in the heart of the authority and empire of popedom? And when he finally came to the rose to the occasion and began to plead with them, and he didn't get any response, and then he prayed. Well, certainly that should work something out. The Pope praying, Vicar of Christ, he ought to get some answer to his prayer. He tried it. It didn't work. The next thing he heard, they'd killed a man. And it said openly, he grieved. He said, I understand the words were, he was angry. He said he called on God, and God didn't answer him. See, that was his response. And it broke his heart. And I'm sure it hastened his death. Because he thought, well, now this is the end of any respect and recognition of our authority. And so along with that, of course, you can recognize all the other, all the nations were involved. Carter got involved, and different nations sent messages to these to these guerrillas who were holding Moro hostage, and it all went to no avail. So I'm sure their knees buckled when they thought of such rebellion against the establishment. And this is what he says here, that she's that the knees smite together, much pain is on all loins, and the face of them all gather blackness, which is the picture of Belshazzar sitting on his throne and seeing this handwriting on the wall. They see it. And just as his knees buckled and his face turned colors, even so it is with Babylon today. So that, now your second chapter is another feature about it, brings in the attack now is on it. He's anticipating the attack by the Medes, and he's also involving Assyria, which was a mighty nation whose favorite attack was siege. You see, siege was a favorite strategy in those days because the waters were surrounding these nations. Tyre, Babylon, Sidon, all of them were merchants. They had, let me give you that, overlapping now. This is the second chapter. We're overlapping into the third to give you the connected aspect of water here. He says that, and we go back to the second and the sixth verse, the gates of the rivers shall be open, and the palace shall be dissolved, which means that the attack would involve the draining of the waters away so that they could enter into her impregnable protection, the walls and the river, and thus overtake the nation. In 3:14, we read, draw thee waters for the siege. That's what we're telling you about now. Fortify thy strongholds. He's telling Nineveh now, do all you can to protect yourself, but it's not going to do you any good. Fortify thy strongholds. Go into clay, tread the mortar, make strong the brick. But the strategy will overcome you. Now then he tells us about the merchants, as we say. We go down to the 16th verse, the third chapter. Thou hast multiplied thy merchants. Being a water territory, they dealt with the sea in trade and exchange of goods. So he says, thou hast multiplied thy merchants above the stars of heaven. The cankerworm spoileth and fleeth away. So this is, again, you go over to the antitypical Babylon, and you see this was her stronghold in Revelation 18. Now, I was reading again this part about how they stand afar off, Revelation 18:10. They shall see the smoke of her burning, standing afar off for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city, Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour is thy judgment come. And then the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, for no man buyeth her merchandise anymore. Merchandise of gold, silver, precious stones, etc., etc. And the merchants, the 15th verse, of the merchants of these things, which were made rich by her, shall stand afar off for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing. This is antitypical Babylon, who deals in merchant trade of exchanging of goods and wealth and diplomats and cardinals. Didn't they all come from all the different nations over the world, including this nation, to go there for this election situation? Merchants of the earth dealing and trading with all these nations. And all of them are going to be affected by her downfall. So now the siege. I want to get you back to that. The strategy of siege is very applicable to the present, to the forthcoming situation, because Amos tells us that what this result will be. We're fast approaching it, but it's going to get much more dark in that area. And Amos 8:11, he says, behold, the day comes, saith the Lord, that I will send a famine in the land, not a famine of bread, nor a thirst for water. And that can be very discomforting, water. You can go without food for a while, but when you can't get water, it's painful. So there should not be not only a famine in the land, not for famine of bread, nor a thirst for water, but of hearing the words of the Lord. And they shall wander from sea to sea, and from the north even to the east, and they shall run to and fro to seek the word of the Lord, and shall not find it. Can you imagine a situation like that, beloved? What would you do if you didn't have the truth? The brethren have been talking to one another, and I've heard that community. What would we do without the truth, even at the present time, let alone the dark day and night wherein no man can work? Every man's hand against his neighbor. At the present time, if you didn't have the truth, what would you do? So imagine the projection of that when there was a famine for the word of the Lord and a thirst, and it cannot be found. That's why, for the elect's sake, it'll have to be cut short, because we probably won't be here at that ultimate situation to supply any enlightenment to the world. And the foolish virgins, their time is running out, because if they're going to ask for oil, they'd better get it in a hurry. The supply is running out as far as they're having access to. So this, because there's going to be a famine in the land, see. And this is a siege. This is the antitypical Cyrus's method of undermining the religious institutions and Babylon. As it is, they don't understand the word of God. And so when it gets darker and the signs become more drastic and they can't find any explanation, then they will be in a state of perplexity from which there is no way out. That's the siege which foreshadows her overthrow. Now this is what happened to Israel. In the AD 70, after Jesus had pronounced the judgment, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how oft would I have gathered thee, and ye would not. Henceforth your house is left unto you desolate. The same has been pronounced on Babylon. The voice of the bridegroom and the bride shall no longer be heard in her, neither the organ nor the pipe instruments, no music in Babylon at all. So desolation, she doesn't have any access to understand these things, and she later will have less access to any information on the state of affairs in the world, why she is crumbling, why the nations are in an uproar, and why the whole civilization is crumbling. They won't know anything about it, and they'll be in a desperate condition. So this was the standard strategy of the Assyrians and the Medes in attacking Nineveh, because it's hard to overthrow a city that's so impregnably defended. It was hard for Israel, hard for them to overthrow Israel. The Maccabees stood out for a long time, and Titus had to go back on a distraction to deal with some other enemies, and it was in that short break period that they remembered what Jesus had said, let him which is in Judea flee to the mountains, and let him which is on the housetop not come down into the house and get anything out, and let him which is in the field run for his life. But pray ye that your flight be not on the Sabbath day, nor in the winter time, for then shall be great tribulation. And those that remember Jesus' words, when this unexpected intermittency occurred, when Titus had to withdraw his army, they fled the city. And those that didn't, of course, got hung up, because when he returned, he put a siege around it, and they put the battering rams on it, just like he says about fortify your walls. And so Titus devised an engine that could propel heavy stones. That's the only way he could break those walls down. They were so powerful and so strong. And eventually he broke the walls down and made an entrance into the city, and those who were there starved to death. Mothers fought over their children's body, and the rest were consumed. So that's the ultimate devastation of a siege. Now, then we go into the third chapter in identification of the nature of this city, why her judgment must come. And we begin at the third chapter now. He says, woe to the bloody city! It is all full of lies and robbery. The prey departeth not. The noise of a whip and the noise of rattling of wheels and the prancing of horses and the jumping of chariots. We'll come to the chariots subsequently. Now this is the identification of her antitype with Babylon in the fourth verse. Because of the multitude of the whoredoms. That's the typical identification of Babylon throughout Revelation. And of the well-favored harlot, the mistress of witchcraft, that selleth nations through her whoredoms and families through her witchcraft. Behold, I am against thee, saith the Lord of hosts. I will discover thy skirts upon thy face, and I will show the nations thy nakedness, and the kingdoms thy shame. They did that literally, of course, in those days. Those were days of Oriental peoples are cruel when it comes to war. They have neither mercy nor pity on the enemy. And Israel had to witness this all through her lifetime in the operations and confrontations amongst these nations. So they were aware of cruelty. But as it applies to antitypical Babylon, I wanted to give you an illustration. Now, let's see if we can find what we did with it. Show you how up-to-date this is. We have to run across this article. And here's what it says. This is, I have an excerpt from the account of the 1970 earthquake in Peru, in which 70,000 persons were killed, as told by Reverend Albert Caprio, a native of Derby, Connecticut. See, that's right in our hometown area, and a Catholic missionary in Peru. Here's what he says, quote, time is a minor problem compared to trying to root out superstition and witchcraft. Didn't I tell you that, how time... You don't consider time. It takes a long time sometimes to get results. So time is not a factor. So as he says here, it's a minor problem into trying to root out superstitions and witchcraft, that's pinpointing the identification, that have become intertwined with their Catholic religion over the centuries. Some use incantations and visit witch doctors, yet see no contradiction with Catholicism. Idolizing statue is common. You know that. We have that in the backyard, you might say, in the area there. They have these special feasts for this one and that one, St. Joseph, St. Mary, and so forth. And the whole street's blocked off, and they carry all these banners, and they throw money in before the idols. It's a mockery. So idolizing statues is common. The people are quick to believe in miracles. For instance, after the earthquake, some people moved a large statue of St. Martin de Perez out of the rubble in the church Caprio was working in at the time and placed it in front of the ruins of the church. I suppose that's supposed to protect the church. I guess the idol didn't fare any better than the church. By the time the information got to the newspapers, people believed that the statue had miraculously walked out of the church by itself. Processions. Oh, they got that today. They're fighting over the altar in one of our states. Forget where it is. And they don't want this altar in the church. And they're having a high time out about it. They're going to throw out the priest over there and get rid of him. People shall... processions with statues adorned in gold and other precious things are popular with the people. People will also spend their last dollars lighting candles in the church. You all heard about that. According to the priest. He doesn't try to overthrow these traditions outright. Instead, he has been trying to gradually reorient the people on such things as the use of their images. Whenever he gets the opportunity, he reminds them that the statues are merely devotional things. We heard that about the beads, you know. You multiply the prayers, and that's merely a discipline, you know, so to make sure you don't forget to pray. So they have all kinds of rationalizations. But this is what Habakkuk explicitly refers to. Because of the multitude of thy whoredoms, which thou art a mischief of witchcraft, the judgments of the Lord shall come upon thee. Now, one more illustration to the addressing to this church relationship, and then we go to the chariots. I have to slow this clock down a little bit. We ran across this article, very interesting that we happened to see it because it falls right into Nahum's context. Ecumenism. You know, there's quite a discussion about that amongst Bible students. So here you get Nahum's point of view. I told you this is the proper danger. See it from Nahum's point of view, and you'll see the right insight into this matter of ecumenism. Ecumenical council has been a thing going on for decades, if not for centuries. Way back in Brother Russell's day, they have them every 10 years, I think. That's nothing new. You don't get excited about that. You should get less excited now. They're having problems. In fact, I have two articles here. One says that they're being stalled in Poland, and they're having troubles over there because, see, the women are getting into this picture now. You're going to bound to have trouble because they want to be priests. And that's got them upset. And they're splitting over that. All the churches are splitting over that. The Lutheran church split. That was on TV. They're not hiding it. Saw that myself. They're seceded. They don't want to... But the Catholic church claimed that that's out of order because they said Christ didn't have any priests for his apostles. And so it's splitting the church. So anyhow, I'm not blaming the women on this. Don't beg my pardon. It's the adversary is behind the overthrowing. And if the women want to help him, it's all right. But it's the fact that the church cannot take that kind of internal disruption. It'll make it fall. And because they're going to fight for their point, and the church is going to suffer as a result. He says ecumenism is quietly pursued at meeting of Anglican bishops. Now, we are pinpointing quietly, because this is the way it works, you know. And this is why many are looking for every sign and indication that this is growing or that it's getting power. I read it here. Ecumenism is merging as the most significant issue among Anglican bishops at the Lambeth Conference, revealing the persistent, though often hidden, power of the drive for church unity. And that's what the brethren have been discussing. Just another section here. Progress toward unity with the Roman Catholic Church and Eastern Orthodoxy has met new impediments. You know what that is? That's obstacles. That's a hurdle that you can't jump over. Such as the conflict over the ordination of women. But most church leaders close to the unity talks do not expect these obstacles to hinder permanently an ecumenical solution which seems to them inevitable. Well, Nahum don't agree with that. Inevitability is not in his vocabulary, except in terms of the downfall. That's the inevitable thing as far as he's concerned. He says, After we read to you about why do you imagine against the Lord he will make another end, affliction shall not rise up the second time, he comes to the church situation. Verse 10, for while they be folded together as thorns, Revelation told you the scrolls would be rolled together, they're thorns because they can't get along, really. They really irritate one another. While they are drunken as drunkards, they're all nations are drunk with the wine of her fornication, they shall be devoured as stubble. That's the end result. Nahum tells us that. Then he tells you to the source of this problem. There is one come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. That's why Isaiah says, say ye not a confederacy to them that say a confederacy, and fear ye not their fear. What's the matter with Bible students worrying about what they shall do and what they shan't do and who they shall restrict and so forth? That's not our concern at all. Nobody can stop us except the Lord. When Jesus was before Pilate, and Pilate said to him, knowest thou not that I have power to destroy thee or to sentence thee? I suppose he pulled up his robe and straightened out his collar when he said that. Don't you understand who I am? And Jesus said, thou hast no power over me, except my Father permitted. That's our position on these matters. He had no fear of power, church power, state power, any kind of power. He was in the hands of his Father. And whatever his Father wanted, ordained was well enough for him. That's our position here. So this one is the one who's behind this arrangement, just as he was behind Jesus' persecution. He imagineth evil. There is one come out of thee that imagineth evil. He belongs there. That's the papacy. The mystery of iniquity, the man of sin, the wicked one, is the seat of his power. And insofar as they bring in other nations or other churches, doesn't make any difference. He's the author of all of their machination. There is a one that come out of thee that imagineth evil against the Lord, a wicked counselor. And then I tie in with what we produced here, this quietness. Notice how he pinpoints it. Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet. Where can you find a more beautiful prophetical insight into a present-day situation? Do you see how accurate Nahum is? Thus saith the Lord, though they be quiet. This says ecumenicism is quietly pursued. That's considered sophisticated strategy. Though they be quiet, and likewise many, told you here the figures of how many millions in this religious world are involved, and though they be likewise many, yet thus shall they be cut down when he shall pass through. Though I have afflicted thee, I will afflict thee no more. That's for Israel. So Israel has the same problem that we theoretically would have had if we were going to see it that way. I don't. The Pope is a dead man as far as I'm concerned. He has no more outlook except troubles. He'll die of heartbreak just like the other one did. But as in the case of Israel's natural enemies, her enemies are many. They are the hosts of Gog and Magog. They come from all the various directions. And they threaten to eliminate Israel and to drive her into the sea. Yes. But Israel shall stand at the latter end, and God shall deliver her. And so any enemies that we may have, the same holds for them. That no matter how many they may be, they cannot harm God's children. Because he says, I will not, even as he says, he will not afflict Israel, he will not permit us to be carrying more than we can bear. So because for Israel, he says again now, for now I will break his yoke from off thee and will burst thy bonds asunder. Which is what he did for Egypt, for Israel under Egypt. That was a yoke of heavy slavery. And what he's going to do for Assyria, what he did for Babylon, when they were under captivity, and what he's doing for Nineveh, who was an anti of Babylon, at the present outlook. Now, just briefly, Isaiah, and then we'll go to the chariot, about how antitypical Cyrus fits into this picture, as we were just telling you. Isaiah 44, as I said, they were under Babylon's yoke. 70 years of desolation looked like a hopeless situation. But the prophets were a part of that. Ezekiel knew about Babylon, and they knew that God was still going to work through this disaster for the good of his cause. And so he says, thus confirmeth the word of his servant, Isaiah 44:26, and performeth the counsel of his messengers. Thus saith to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited. Didn't look like that. Deserted, captive, trodden down of the Gentiles. But the prophet says, thus saith the counsel of his messengers to Jerusalem, thou shalt be inhabited, and to the cities of Judah ye shall be built. And I will raise up the decayed places thereof, restore the tabernacle of David. Thus says to the deep, the waters be dry. I will dry up thy rivers. There's Cyrus drying up the rivers of the Euphrates, which is the fortress of Babylon. I will dry up thy rivers. Thus saith of Cyrus, that saith of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. That's Jesus, the present king. And the kings of the east, for which all of this operation is preparing their way, is the church. Don't you see how you are a part of this picture? You can't afford not to be aware of what's going on. Everything that's happening is for your sakes. Have you thought of that? Or you went to sleep? Don't want to hear about the troubles. Makes you nervous? Makes us joyful. He is my shepherd and shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, thou shalt be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Thus saith the Lord to the anointed, his anointed Cyrus. This is Jesus. His name was the Son of Righteousness. See how these types spell themselves out. Whose right hand I have upholden to subdue nations before him, and I will loose the loins of kings to open before him the two leaf gates, and the gates shall not be shut. Even the doors of the prison house of death will not be able to hold the prisoners therein, for he shall open the gates. The gates of hell shall not even prevail against the church, of course. Neither shall they prevail against the world, because he shall loosen the gates and let the prisoners go forth. Say unto the prisoners, come out, come forth. This is what our antitypical Cyrus is presently engaged in. So Nahum, as I said, beautifully projects this to this state of anticipation. Now we go back to the chariot projection, and then we give you what you would have found in the reprint if you had looked it up. In reprint, and this is classical, and this is wonderful, because it's not that much about Nahum, and if we were depending only on the reprint, of course, we wouldn't have been able to get these information, all this information assembled and compacted, but it gives us enough of a key to know that there is something worth digging for, and that's encouraged us. So on page 480, the article begins on 479, and it's entitled Invisible Things of Him, and we had already used that as a key for our present signs by letting you know about the 100-year period that has brought out all these inventions. And telephone, I sent one of our brethren a copy. We had our last telephone book, when we have now, has 100 years centennial remembrance on it of the telephone's progress. It came into operation back there in those days, Bell, Alexander Bell, I guess it was. And lightning, of course, came into the picture, Benjamin Franklin. So I was glad lightning for her. That's the key. Nahum projects you into this. And now, of course, the telephone is a highly sophisticated technological advanced state that it's hard to describe it. You've got new computerized systems and laser beam projections and so forth. Now, Nahum gives you all this information. That's my point. The day of its preparation. We read on page 480. While we would not be fanciful nor morbidly imaginative, and I'm not trying to speculate here, he says, we would not be too slow to mark the striking coincidence of events which seem to indicate the fulfillment of prophecy. That's what we're looking for. Could anyone say, who is most familiar with the railroads of the present day, which the railroads of the present day give in so few words, so clear and vivid a description of locomotives and railroad carriages as is given in the second chapter of the prophecy of Nahum in these words? Is Nahum's words. The chariots shall be with flaming torches in the day of his preparation, and the fir trees shall be terribly shaken. Hear me now. The chariots shall rage in the streets. They shall jostle one another against jostle against one another in the broad ways. Hear me. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. Lightning is a significant manifestation of the power of the Lord. What is he referring to? Oh, he's told you. Take your railroads. Visualize them in terms of Nahum's projection. See how he visualized them. That's all he could describe them as. When you watch, even on your highway, see chariots, beloved, there are any means of conveyance. They happen to use chariots then. You have different methods now, but take your automobiles, because that you see every day. You go on your highway tonight, but don't leave tonight. Wait till after Monday. When you go home on your highway, watch the stream of traffic coming towards you, and don't they look like torches? All you see is headlights. Fire! Flaming torches, that's all they look like, you see, in the dark of the night. And how fast are they moving? Like lightning. There's your automobile. The trains are the same way. You go on the railroad and watch, go to Grand Central at night and watch the multiplicity of railroads and the trains coming in and out with their blazing torches of light as the only indications of their approach, oncoming speed. And watch how they run like the lightning. Go up in the air. Oh, you got to get with Nahum. He's not stopping there. Go up in the air, and you've got as much traffic over there, if not more, than you got on the ground. Watch those lights blinking when you get over to the airports, and you see the trains coming in and out. Well, go way over here. You've got an airport here, I think, in Chicago. Yeah. You better have. Go over to O'Hare's airport. I was thinking of Kennedy and LaGuardia, but I forgot you got the same thing here. So you don't have to come out there to see it. Stay right here. Go to O'Hare Airport at night and watch those planes coming in and out and crossing one another. And this light says like torches. So he goes on to say, the chariot shall race in the streets. They shall jostle one another in the broad ways. They shall seem like torches. They shall run like the lightnings. But says one that this is a prophecy concerning Nineveh? Very true. But like most of all of his prophecies, it doubtless has a twofold significance. I'm reading out of the reprint. Like the prophecy concerning Babylon, which is generally understood to refer to the apostate church of Rome, as well as to the ancient city of that name, so this prophecy is understood by some, and with good reason, we think, to refer to the world and to the conditions affecting both the church and the world, and has an application in this time. But whatever may be thought concerning it, one thing is evident, that no carriages or chariots in Nineveh, nor anywhere in the history of the world, would so well answer to the description here given, meaning as our own modern fast-moving vehicles demonstrate. So in conclusion, beloved, Nahum identifies himself with Isaiah once again when he says, behold, upon the mountains of the feet of him that bringeth good tidings, this is 1:15, that publisheth peace. O Judah, keep thy solemn feast, perform thy vows, for the wicked shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. That's the prophetic view. The enemies shall no more pass through thee. He is utterly cut off. Can you see that far? As Nahum saw. And we turn to Isaiah and get the beautiful prophecy, which is where we left you when we were here before. So it takes on an increased significance as we see it developing along the same lines with increasing momentum. Isaiah 49. 40, the chapter, 9th verse. Well, we begin with the first verse because that's the message to Jerusalem. This is Judah and Israel that's involved here. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. We have that for our message. Be of good comfort. Tomorrow we'll talk about that for Israel. Comfort ye, my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned, for she has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. The voice of him that crieth in the wilderness, that's Elijah, prepare ye the way of the Lord, that's what we're proclaiming. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. For the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. That's what we told you about Apocalypse. And all flesh shall see it together, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. And then our message as we go to the mountaintop to proclaim it in the ninth verse. O Zion that bringeth good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain. O Jerusalem that bringeth good tidings, lift up thy voice with strength. Lift it up, be not afraid, say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Behold, the Lord will come with a strong hand, and his arm shall rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his work is before him. As pertains to us now, we get this beautiful afterthought. He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. Isn't that what you've been enjoying, beloved, since the harvest message was presented? Don't you appreciate it all the more in these days of trouble? He shall feed his flock like a shepherd. He shall gather the lambs in his arms. You should feel that, the loving, tender care of the Lord through the ministry of the truth and the various agency he's using. He shall gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom. Don't you feel that tender, loving care of the Lord for his people? You sing, O thy loving kindness, O thy loving kindness, O how great. You have that as a hymn. That's the nature of our God to his special beloved elect class. He shall carry them in his bosom and shall gently lead those that are with young, those who are ministering the truth and who are endeavoring to be a source of comfort to the Israel of God. He helps them to perform their services on their behalf. And this is what he used Brother Russell to do for us, and he's still caring, still performing the same services through the present agencies that are available. So it's wonderful for Israel. Natural Israel is due for her words of comfort, which we have been instrumental in promulgating. And spiritual Israel has her special period of consolation because, behold, upon the mountains, how beautiful are the feet that publishes peace, that publishes salvation, that publishes good news, that saith unto Zion, thy God reigneth, which means that your glorification, your redemption is at hand, and the beauty of the Lord shall be exalted in all the earth. May the Lord add his blessing.
Now don't go away, Brother Levi. We have some questions to ask you. And so we have a period of time now. The class has granted you a favor if you have some questions after having listened to this explanation. We will take a little time for some questions. We'll be open for questions. Someone a question. Brother Lawrence.
In Nahum 1:3, we read, the clouds are the dust of his feet. Is there any significance in that statement, Brother Levi?
You hear the question?
Yes, sir.
Will you read it?
Thank you. So, yeah, I'd be very happy to. Very good idea. Yes, a suggestion that suggested that we read it so that everyone understand what the question refers to. Nahum is even a difficult book to find. But don't let that let you underestimate its importance. The hard things sometimes are hard to find, too. Good things, I should say, are hard to find. We have to dig and search for them. Nahum 1:3, the Lord is slow to anger and great in power and will not at all acquit the wicked. The Lord has his way in the whirlwind and in the storm, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. I think there are various suggestions that might be just as applicable one as against another. But in Revelation again, when you go back to the comparison of Nahum with John, we find the clouds used to identify our Lord's arrival. He says, I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle, and the earth was reaped. So you see, and when he went up, Jesus identified himself with clouds. He went up in the cloud, and it says, ye men of Galilee, I think it was. Why stand ye here gazing? The same Jesus who ye see ascending shall so come in like manner. Now, clouds very often represents trouble. As you know, when you see clouds, you look up and you figure that if they're black clouds, of course, they're signs of trouble. If they're white clouds, it's a little different. So either way, they have a symbolic significance. So in this particular context where it says clouds are the dust of his feet, I think it refers to the time of trouble in which the world will find itself during this day of his preparation. There will be multiple troubles all over the globe. And they are the dust of his feet, which means that they are symbolical of the fact that all these valleys and mountains and hills and seas are going to be dissolved in clouds of trouble. There's a beautiful picture in Canticles about Jesus leaping upon the mountains and skipping upon the hills. Now, if you get up on a high mountain, or get on a mountain high enough, you'll be in the midst of a cloud. That's in Oregon. I think that's very typical over there. They have Oregon, I suppose, also, and Seattle, Washington. And you get up high enough and you're right in the clouds, you see. So it's in the dust of these clouds that he leaps upon the mountains and causes them to shake and tremble and then be carried into the midst of the sea and the hills melt. So the clouds are symbolical of trouble, which is typical of the presence of the Lord in dealing with our present civilization. The white cloud, of course, is for us a symbol of the fact that our deliverance is at hand, that he brings encouragement to spiritual Israel, that he has the authority to deal with their problems, and he will turn their problems into joys.
Thank you, Brother Levi. We must hurry. Is there another question? Another question? Sister?
Maybe I misunderstood, but did you say that all the seven plagues were poured out already?
Yes, that's...
They're all complete.
The question is, did we say that all the seven plagues are poured out? All right, we'll give you the context for that, since you may want to look it up. In the 15th chapter, you begin with them. I saw, as it were, the sea of glass. He says, and I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues. For in them is filled up the wrath of God. Now, in the 15th verse, in the 15th chapter following on to the 5th verse, he says, sixth verse, and the seven angels came out of the temple, having the seven plagues, clothed in pure and white linen, and their breast girdle. Now, then you go on to the 16th, and you get the sequence of the plagues. They're on the earth. They're on the sea. Third is on the waters. I'll give you an illustration that we mentioned about the Pope, because he was just put in his power. And you'll see he's brought to our attention here that the eighth verse, and the fourth angel poured out his vial upon the sun. I told you about the sun. They're all conscious about the sun. And the power was given on him to scorch men with fire. You've heard that recently in Texas. They had 120 degrees heat and people were killed. So the fourth angel poured out its vial upon the sun. Power was given unto him to scorch men with fire. The men were scorched with great heat. Blasphemed God. I told you about what the Pope said when Mara, he prayed to God to save Mara, and they shot him. He blasphemed. Why didn't God answer? So the men were scorched with great heat, blasphemed the name of God, which hath power over these plagues, and they repented and gave not the glory to God. Now the sixth angel is the river Euphrates. I told you about that being dried up. That was way back in the days of the pastor. And then the seventh plague, I'll give you that because that's the great earthquake. You know about earthquakes by now to know that. In 18th verse, it says, the seventh angel put out his vial in the air, and there was great voices, the temple of heaven from the throne, saying, it is done. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings and a great earthquake, such as it never was since there was a nation. So the relevancy of your multiplicity of earthquakes is to identify that the plagues have been poured out.
Another question? Have time for one more? One more question. Don't all wait for everyone else, friends. Yes, brother.
I believe, Brother Jacobs, you made mention that regarding the dark night, that every man's hand would be against his neighbor. What would be your thought on when and how this would take place?
Thank you. That's a quote from the third volume, I believe. The question was brought out as to, or suggestion was made as to the three possible ways in which the kingdom work could be brought to a conclusion. One would be a date specifying that the church was to go home. Another would be a conversion of the world on such a large scale that everybody would be accepting the truth. And the third would be the dark night, in which no more work could be done. So we'd know that the church's work was finished. Now, as to the way in which we believe, of course, it would be the third one. It wouldn't be the second. I don't see any inundating numbers coming into the truth enough to warrant the fact that we're going to convert the world. And the dates are out. We've already considered that out of order. So the dark night would be the possible alternative. And as to how and when that will occur, you do not now, I think, have to reckon with the time projection anymore, because it could happen any time. And I think your latest sign here is your post office situation. When you get to a state of affairs where of course you had it in the gas situation, the brother brought it out, and we in the East knew about that, because you just couldn't get oil, and you couldn't get gas, you couldn't get oil either. Oil was hard to get, because we had homes without heat. And I was in the midst of that there. And gas you couldn't buy for a while. You'd lined up and who's going to wait for an hour to buy gas? So you just couldn't go travel. You just had to cut off your traveling, and you do what best you could. So that would be a possible way in which you would have your work activity circumvented on general scale. And then the post-op situation. If it became serious enough and they cut off your mail supplies, that would be a sign that you're running into this dark night projection. Now, we're not saying that this is going to happen tomorrow. We're saying that you have the situation that you can visualize, that there is a dark night moving in which there will be circumvention of activities in all areas, whether traveling, whether by the Arabs, incidentally, on this next conference, this is another projection of Nahum, bringing Saudi Arabia with them. And they say that is bringing Saudi Arabia with him, and Saudi Arabia is the source of our oil. If they don't come to an agreement and Saudi Arabia says, forget the oil, we're out of the market, there will begin some of our dark night. So these are various possibilities: post office situation, oil shortage, disruptions of government, strikes in various areas in which your whole community activities would be disrupted and the work would just about come to a halt.
Any thoughts about every man's hand against his?
Yes, thank you. That's a beautiful comment to bring up. Every man's hand against his neighbor. We bring that up to date because the brethren have been in the concept that this is a mob brawl situation in which everybody is getting mad with everybody else. That wouldn't do any good. That's just criminality. That's not anarchy. The every man's hand against his neighbor, which is the equivalent of anarchy, is on the professional scale, which you see it happening, in which professional anarchists who are trained for guerrilla warfare and undercover activity and hostage-taking tactics infiltrate into the government and by various ruthless means disrupt the organization of the government, obstruct its implementation, and destroy the coordination of your community activities. And at the present time, with your union situation on strike, strike is a plague now. Strike is spreading all over the country. Everything is going on. Everybody's going on strike. But you didn't see it before in terms of the government. Teachers, forget your children. They just not going to go to school. Policemen, got no protection. They're just not going to protect you. Firemen, they'll help burn your house down. So you got every man's hand against his neighbor, and this is the situation that we're working into on a very grand momentum. That's the application on a professional scale in which all society is at loggerheads and everyone is caught in the middle.
Thank you, Brother Levi. We call to mind that thought that we're willing to work, we will work a willing horse, I was going to say to death, but very hard anyway. And we appreciate this long session at your sharing with us your thoughts on Nahum and on these other prophecies and dark sayings, and we appreciate it very much. We have used up our time, dear friends, so we'll ask Brother Levi to close this session by thanking the Lord and seeking his blessing, closing this session with prayer. Brother Levi.
Our kind and gracious Heavenly Father, we come into thy presence with grateful hearts to have been enlightened through thy word of truth and by thy Spirit to perceive thy stately steppings amongst the nations and in the midst of the church, ordering the affairs of Israel to towards the grand consummation of her deliverance, and also natural Israel, preparing her for the time when out of Zion shall come forth the deliverer that shall turn away ungodliness from Jacob, and preparing the world for the new highway whereby a fool shall not err therein, but they shall walk up to the glorious heritage of ultimate restitution and perfection. And though there is a day of trouble and a dark night, we recognize that thou art a stronghold in the day of trouble. So we pray that we may absorb all the comfort that thou hast provided for us on this occasion and in our private sessions, that we may be uplifted and encouraged and rejoice in thy workings in our midst. Bless the further sessions of this convention, bless the testimonies, and bless the operations and sacrifices that are being made to make this a grand occasion of blessing and glorifying thy name. We ask these favors in Jesus' name. Amen.
You know, that every man's hand against his neighbor, it seems.